Ladies and gentlemen, seekers of knowledge, we resume the last part of our symposium, and we have reserved some of the very best for this last session. And the first among these is the esteemed William Easterling, who will be speaking to us on modes of agricultural adaptation to climate change. This is going to be interesting, and please come and take your seats and open your minds. Thank you. Go right ahead.
Thank you, Dan. Good afternoon, folks. This is the first time that that I've spoken in front of many of you, my friends, my colleagues, since I crossed over the dark side and became dean of a college at Penn State, and which convinces my faculty that I've lost 30 IQ points right off the bat. But let me assure you, I am eminently qualified to give this talk, I often point out that deans come as three types, those who can count and those who can't. Got you. It's late in the afternoon. You can be excused. Well, what I thought as I prepared for this talk that, you know, there are only so many things you can do in 15 minutes, and I'm not going to show you a lot of research results of a particular study, but rather just raise some basic issues that I think we all ought to be thinking about. And I want to start out by stating what I think is the obvious, but so many times when you get into the hallowed halls of Congress and in policy settings, the obvious isn't always quite so obvious, and that is that adaptation is not new. Adaptation is what pays our checks, really, most of us in this room. We are always adapting, and in agriculture, it may be one of the most eminently adaptable enterprises, human enterprises, in 8,000 years. And so let's just talk about some of these more general issues. And let me start. How do I advance things here, Cynthia?
There you go.
Very good. Thank you. Let me start by just, again, with the atmosphere. Why is adaptation crucial? And I think there are many, many examples I could show you, but one that really strikes me is that the climate modeling community in the IPCC AR4 report is convinced that even if we were to take the unrealistic step of backing atmospheric greenhouse gas concentrations back to year 2000 levels, the climate system of the Earth is still committed to about as much warming in the future as we have experienced over the past 100 years, about 0.6 to 0.7 degrees C global average warming. And I often, for those who aren't climatologists, find it useful to point out as a point of reference that the Earth has only warmed about 5 degrees C since the end of the last ice age, since the end of the Pleistocene. So the amount of warming that we've experienced and that we're committed to is about 20% or more of the warming that we've experienced since the last time that glaciers were about 500 miles north of here or less. And so adaptation to climate in particular is something that is unavoidable in the future. Now, we talk about adaptation and resiliency in very casual ways, and I want to point out that they are, at least in the systems ecology literature, really quite different terms. They're related, but it is useful to point out, for more than just semantic discussion, why they're different. And I often go to a device that many of you I know have seen that derives of work of Buzz Holling, a very respected systems ecologist, in describing how a system is resilient and at the same time adaptive. And it's useful to kind of think in a highly abstract level about this and imagine an agroecosystem as a sphere that's at rest in a system of hills and valleys, that those valleys consist of the boundary conditions, both biotic and abiotic, that constrain both ecological process and form. And that when there is a external forcing of that ecosystem, it could be a pest outbreak, it could be a climate event such as a major drought. It pushes the ball up the side of the valley, conceptually, and if the system is resilient as the disturbance eases, as it abates, that sphere will simply move back at rest in the same valley it started out at. It's like a rubber band. It stretches, it stretches, it stretches, and eventually it snaps back into place as the forcing eases. So that, my friends, is resiliency. The ecosystem doesn't change shape, it doesn't change form, it doesn't change process. It has built in the ability to absorb this shock and resume function. Now, adaptation is different. This is when the external disturbance pushes and pushes and the sphere moves up the side of the valley, and eventually it overtops the crest and it moves into a new state of equilibrium. And in this new state, it is fundamentally reorganized. The essential ingredients, the nutrients, the energy fluxes, everything, the material is the same. It's just reorganized in a fundamentally different way. And it's hard to say which is better, but think about this, if you will, for a moment, because a challenge we have in adapting agriculture to climate change is, are we willing to expend the kinds of resources, both human capital and money, to try to keep an agricultural system functioning exactly the way we see it today under a climate that's changing? And Lord knows there are other kinds of social and economic changes that are pressuring our agricultural production systems. And so this is one issue that we do have to come to grips with. And speeding ahead, let me give you just some examples, very simple, almost child's play examples, of the kinds of things that we in the climate and agriculture modeling community have explored as methods for being more resilient in the face of climate change. We've heard about changing planting dates. We've talked about changing cultivar maturity classes. We've talked about moisture and conservation tillage, moisture and soil tillage conservation, deploying irrigation where the water's available and it's economical, or switching crops and or crop rotations. You know, these are things that farmers aren't going to have to be told to do, and the support establishment for farmers will be more than enough to facilitate these kinds of resilient responses to climate change. But there are certainly examples, and here just a salute to Dave Lobel. You can learn a lot by looking backward in time at what could happen in analogous situations to climate change. For example, the experience with farming systems adapting to the slow but steady decline in groundwater on the Ogallala Aquifer. This is a pretty well-studied phenomenon, and we know, I think many in this room, that irrigation from the High Plains Aquifer was fundamental in allowing row cropping to extend into the far western Great Plains. But that water is essential fossil water. It doesn't recharge very quickly, and when you draw it down at the rate that it was being drawn throughout the past 30 to 40 years, that water level is dropping. It's like oil. It's a non-renewable resource in a sense. And so the question is, did farming cease out there because the irrigation water became too expensive to pump as the groundwater levels fell, as the saturated thicknesses diminished? And the answer is no, of course not. It just simply reorganized. Farms became fewer in number, larger. The expectations of yields lowered appropriately, and dry land practices resumed like they had been successful back before World War II. So in this case, there was a fundamental reorganization of the farming system. And so that's adaptation. And it may involve some pain, let's face it. All right, let me shift gears now that I've laid that out for you. And just, you know, there are many priorities, and there's no way I'm going to hit all your favorite priorities for what we ought to be thinking about for better understanding adaptation, for improving the science of adaptation to climate change. The first thing that I think we've talked around a lot today, and that I'll just simply reinforce, is that the models that we use, whether they are empirical, historical models, or whether they're physiologically based simulation models, are all imperfect representations of reality. And I think we all agree to that. And that it's critical that these models, I assert, be major tools for decision making in the highest levels of government. And if that's the case, then we just have to do a better job of constraining uncertainty in these models. And one way to begin to get to this is to borrow from what the climate modelers have been very successful in, and that's creating model ensembles. And what do I mean by that? Well, one of the things that we did, I think, courageously, humbly, in the IPCC Fourth Assessment Report was to look over almost 100 physiologically based crop modeling studies done the world over, separating them into major grain crops and looking at the temperate regions as opposed to the tropical regions of the earth, and trying to pick out general trends in yields as they respond to different levels of temperature change. Now, we did this, as I said, with some humility, with lots of assumptions that we know have to be made in this type of approach. And we found that, in general, the temperate yields tend to hold or even improve with a little bit of temperature change for the major grain crops we looked at. But in the tropics, any temperature change at all, and we see immediate yield declines. Adaptation, these studies also had a component in them where these resilient strategies, for example, changing the planting dates or the cultivar selections, tended to buy some buffering both in the temperate latitudes and in the tropics. But again, the temperate latitudes come away winners relative to the tropics. But these are highly assumption-laden comparisons. And what we really need is organized studies where we take these models and other approaches to estimating the effect of climate change on crop yields, and that have the ability to incorporate adaptations for us to experiment with, that we have common sets of inputs, and that we have a way of doing sophisticated uncertainty analyses based on these common sets of inputs, whether they're management practices, soil types, all the different inputs that go into the crop model, as well as the climate change assumptions that are put into the models. Until we start to do this, we really don't have a way of giving the policy community the kinds of uncertainty information that is required to make reasoned decisions about the investment of scarce resources. Uncertainty not only is a problem in convincing policymakers to make certain types of decisions, but it's also implicit in understanding the costs of adaptation. Adaptation will not be costless. And there are a number of approaches that are being developed now. Back 2 or 3 years ago, when we were finishing the fourth assessment report, there was a surprisingly small number of studies that had pondered the question of, gee, how much do you think it's going to cost us to adapt to a certain amount of climate change? Just the techniques of switching farms from one type of farming system, one type of cropping system, to another. What would that cost? So we're now beginning to start to get more studies that are doing this kind of work, and we need a lot more. A study that was done by Charlie Kolstad and colleagues out at Cal Berkeley, or Cal Santa Barbara, rather, looked at just what is the cost that's imposed by farmers not appropriately recognizing the signal of climate change and immediately or not changing their production practices in sync with climate change. And the implication being that with more time elapsed while you're out of sync with climate change, you're not recognizing the signal appropriately, that is a cost, an adaptation cost. And then where does the optimal decision begin to have an impact with respect to climate change on your yields? So this is some results from a study that was done looking at changing a management strategy to grow winter wheat, and this, I believe, is in Chile, yes, and imposing that strategy and waiting to see whether or not the climate change evolves to the point where that strategy actually starts to make sense in terms of crop yields. And you can see that there is a time where the optimal strategy for adapting wheat to a 2080 climate crosses over just doing nothing but staying attuned to the practice of today. So these are studies that we never had 5 years ago to draw on in trying to understand the cost and effectiveness of adaptation. And then finally, my last point is climate is not the only thing that is going to change in the future. We all, I think, know that the demand for food and fiber will continue to increase. Now, the agricultural economists say that demand will begin to slow as we move out into the latter stages of the 21st century. But nonetheless, we will be faced with raising agricultural production worldwide a considerable amount above what it is today, just to stay apace with the growth in world demand. And so it's not as though we're aiming at a stationary target in adapting agriculture to climate change. We're aiming at a moving target. And one question that we may want to ask is, what kind of agricultural production system or systems will we want to have in 20, 30, 40, 50 years? And then to design our agricultural production systems accordingly. Now, I know I'm running a little bit low on time, so let me just finish by saying, you know, the Australians are doing this already, and I think we ought to take note of it. They are already beginning a dialogue in their research community of what does the optimal production system look like with respect to preserving environmental values, adapting to climate variability and change, and at the same time meeting the needs of people for food and fiber. So with that, I'll stop, and I guess our question and answers will come later.
Thank you, Bill. Thank you, Dr. Easterling, for that informative, interesting, and thought-provoking presentation.